Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. Just want to say as we start here this morning that Judge Sparks will be participating by phone. Our first case this morning is United States v. Jones. Captain Armstrong, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Barr, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I would like to preserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Res geste is a doctrine of narrow confines. Res geste is limited to evidence that are inextricably intertwined, or it is temporally or causally or spatially related to the main events. Only other exception is if the evidence bridges narrative gaps. Here, upholding the military judge's decision to admit this evidence would greatly expand this narrow doctrine because the search not only happened the day after, it happened after 5 significant intervening events. The first was interruption by Shelby Dean. Second was Shelby Dean's confrontation with the appellant and confrontation of Ms. Agee's brother. And after that, subsequently, he got arrested by the military police. The next day, early morning, he was interviewed at the CID station. And during that interview, these exact terms that appeared in prosecution's exhibit number 5 was either asked by appellant or he was advised, when he was advised, especially in the beginning, of strangulation, he asked, "What is strangulation? I do not understand." And the CID agent explained, "It essentially means choking," and that's the exact term that appears in the search term. And he also was asked, "What is the proper punishment?" So he's, also answering, "Maybe dishonorable discharge is one of the possibilities," and that is another term that appears in the search terms.
Now, obviously, you're arguing that it was ruled on by the military judge as res geste evidence rather than consciousness of guilt. What is this court to make of the fact, however, that in the matter submitted to the convening authority, that trial defense counsel stated, quote, "The government argued that the internet searches went to consciousness of guilt." Are we to make of that that, in fact, there was knowledge within that courtroom that this was not being introduced as res geste evidence, as you're arguing right now?
No, Your Honor, because that was not argued. If you look at the transcript, that was not argued in front of the military judge. This was only presented to the convening authority. So if we're looking at whether the convening authority made a mistake, maybe we can look at that portion. But what has happened in the court trial transcript?
Now, when you say the convening authority made a mistake, do you really mean whether trial defense counsel made a mistake? That's what the trial defense counsel said, not what the convening authority said.
That may be, but here we're going to look at what has happened in front of the military judge and whether military judge had this, abused her discretion. So when we are looking at what she was looking at, what finding of facts she made, what legal principles she has used, we need to look at what was said on the record, and no mention of consciousness of guilt was in the record, and only state of mind was mentioned, and that does not mean it's a consciousness of guilt. State of mind is also 404B related evidence where you could intent, motive, all of these are state of mind. So just being state of mind doesn't mean it's confined to consciousness of guilt. The other reason why this was used as a res geste is that the government argued this is what he did it in the state of mind when he did it at the JA 110. So they are not saying this is something happened later. They are projecting this state of mind onto what he was doing during the assault, and they are doing it to do two things. First, they are making appellant to have malicious intent, forethought, and plan when he was committing the assault, and they are also discrediting appellant's testimony and also, I'm sorry, statement at the CID, he was just, this was one-time incident, and he didn't have any plan to have done any of these things. And in his sworn statement, he also mentions that. And this also, another dangerous thing that's happening in this search terms is he is essentially asking a question, you know, average person would call and ask his attorneys, what are the implications of this? Can you explain what these are? So it is touching upon his constitutional right to defend himself. So this is why it was so dangerous to use these terms to make him look like bad guy who has the propensity. They literally.
So you're arguing that it was highly prejudicial.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your brief, you don't cite the Colbeck factors. You don't cite the Frost standard. You don't cite Article 59A standard. Why is that? When we're looking at the issue of prejudice.
Your Honor, I believe I cited Frost and Colbeck, but suggested other tests. But I believe that although the notice has specific harm, in this case, even under Colbeck facts, we would still win because of the prejudicial nature of this evidence and how government has used it to argue that this.
Well, that's simply focusing on what you believe to be the prejudicial nature of it. But if you're going through the Colbeck factors, what about the strength of the government's case here?
Yes, Your Honor. Strength of the government case is first factor, but we have to look at all four factors in taking the second, third, fourth, especially.
Okay, but let's go through them in order. In terms of the strength of the government's case, wasn't it extraordinarily strong here?
Yes, Your Honor, it was strong. However, just because government's case strong doesn't mean they, again, that also highlights the prejudice because they did not have to paint him as this, person who is grooming and doing everything on purpose. And especially when you look at this sentencing portion, Your Honor.
Well, let's kind of break that down, though. In terms of showing how prejudicial it was, we're looking separately at the issue of the strength of the government's evidence here, and you seem to be conceding that, in fact, it was very strong. Wasn't it also the situation where the defense case was very weak? All we really had here was the ability on the part of the defense to try to point out some inconsistencies in this child victim's testimony. Do you find something more there in terms of the strength of the defense case?
Yes, Your Honor. Defense was not able to, for example, interview the victim beforehand because the military judge did not allow that. And also,
issue is not before this court.
No, Your Honor, but it's just pointing to the prejudice they were facing. They were not able to show the strength of their case because it was a limited questioning. But even with that, in their closing, defense points out there are 9 different versions of events and highlighted the specific parts that were inconsistent. For example, initially she said sex never happened, and then other inconsistencies that was a contentious part of the actual issue. So it was not extraordinarily strong. It was strong, but also the government was pointing out eyewitness. The eyewitness did not see really anything, so it was again.
Well, to say the eyewitness didn't see anything, I'm not sure that really is reflected in the record. In terms of the eyewitness coming in and seeing appellant with his trousers down around his ankle.
Yes, sure.
And
that's correct.
Pants completely down and the girl on the bed and so forth.
Right. But, with first two factor being the way it is, we can also look at that third and fourth factor. And also I would like to direct
Let's look at the third and fourth factors.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, Chief, were you finished?
No, please.
Okay.
So, in U.S. v. Yamamin, they looked at the evidence that was admitted, and since that was similarly unnecessary evidence, the way they used it as a propensity evidence, they thought this added new ammunition, and if there is if it's not redundant, if it's a new evidence that they can rely whole new argument just on this evidence, that was found to be prejudicial and material and qualitatively prejudicial. So following U.S. v. Yamamin, this court could find this was prejudicial, especially looking at the words they used, bad guy in plain sight, wolf in sheep's clothing, man in the mask lurking in the shadows, evil in our home, monster under the bed.
Okay, but isn't that a separate issue? I mean, that is not tied to the issue of the search terms and that evidence that was admitted. Those types of comments were based on the relationship between appellant and the victim and the victim's relative.
No, Your Honor. The victim and relatives, they never said appellant had forethought, malice to do these things. They never said he planned it. And even appellant in his interview, he pointed out that he's the one, he did not initiate these acts. And although he clarified, I'm not blaming her, I take full responsibility, but I wasn't planning on it. I was weak and I made a huge mistake. But the government went out of their way to make him look like he was grooming her. And aside from this evidence, none of the victims said he was a bad guy who was planning all these things all this time. He has been helping Miss A.G.'s family, babysitting, going to groceries, giving them money. All of these things are in the record, but only bad intent evidence is this. Evidence, wrongly mischaracterized as bad intent evidence.
So babysitting, buying groceries, and all these types of things, that's not evidence of grooming where the trial counsel could base the closing argument on that behavior and not on the search terms that he used the next day?
That would be highly speculative, especially because none of the evidence points to that fact. And this appellant actually showed all of his text messages with Ms. A.G. and photos during CID interview, and they looked at it, and none of those evidence were admitted. He's saying that I didn't plan this, and look at Ms. A.G.'s evidence. She was in on it, and she was saying, all these things, and none of those were admitted in the record. That shows that there was no other evidence, Your Honor. And also, military judge sentenced him almost 4 years more than the government asked for. So this had an impact on the fact finder, clearly, instead of looking at it this one-time mistake that he has made, it was looked at he was grooming and working towards this goal.
Counsel, I have a question. I sort of see there are three avenues that this evidence could have come in, either as res geste or as consciousness of guilt or as 4-4-B evidence. And given that the military judge is presumed to know the law and that the military judge casts doubt on its being either res geste or 4-4-B evidence, why would we not presume that she admitted it as consciousness of guilt evidence?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First, again, as I stated earlier, obviously that phrase never came into contention. And also,
but we don't have any case law that requires magic words in this circumstance, right?
In consciousness of guilt cases, Staten, Clay, and the other previous CAT cases point out that if you're going to use consciousness of guilt evidence, make sure the actual evidence is indicative of guilt, because it is also very highly prejudicial sort of evidence when you're saying, because you're guilty, you're doing something bad. So they were warning that this is not something that just can come in. And here, again, this search was conducted after CID interview, where he just been advised of his rights and what crimes he was facing, and he's simply doing research. And so the military.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. No, I was going to follow up on that question. That is it then your position that it's because of the timing of when the search occurred that makes knocks it out of the realm of possibility of consciousness of guilt? Or are you saying that the words themselves are not indicative of consciousness of guilt?
Both, Your Honor, and especially combined. Because when it happened, and also what the search terms were, and also relation to what actually happened at the CID interview, it is not indicative of consciousness of guilt evidence. In Your Honor, the military judge is finding of facts, even if she found consciousness of guilt, it's not supported by the records. So that's why this court can't find consciousness of guilt.
I see your time has expired. Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you. Captain Barr.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Patrick Barr, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Christopher Burgess, represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's ruling because the military judge did not abuse her discretion in admitting evidence as consciousness of guilt. And even if there was error, there was no substantial impact on the findings or sentence in this case. To start, this evidence is not res geste or covered by Military Rule of Evidence 404B. It is consciousness of guilt evidence, and that is consistent with what the military judge stated on the record.
Now, why should we go along with the government's position here? We've got a situation where trial counsel never uttered the word consciousness of guilt. Never said that. Did use the words res gestae, though. Secondly, trial counsel did not have clean hands here. Trial counsel didn't put this before the court ahead of time. And so you have trial defense counsel left scrambling. This isn't the way things are supposed to happen in a military courtroom. And then we've got a situation where the military judge admitted the material and didn't state the evidentiary basis. So why should we grant you the benefit of the doubt in terms of what happened here?
Yes, Your Honor. To the first point, while the trial counsel did not say the words consciousness of guilt, he effectively described consciousness of guilt and labeled it incorrectly res geste. What he's describing...
Pass those words by me again.
Yes, Your Honor. He said he searched specific terms that go to his state of mind immediately after the assault. Then he categorized that as res geste, which the government believes was an error. And then he said he's looking up things of what he just did, and it goes right to his state of mind that this was an assault, that he knew it was an assault, and that he was looking it up. And that's the important part there, Your Honor, is that he knew it was an assault. That is describing a consciousness of guilt. And while he doesn't say that, that's after the military judge has told him, I don't see how this is res geste. So she says, I don't see how this is res geste, and he tries a second avenue describing that he knew it was an assault, and this is evidence that he knew it was an assault. That's a description of consciousness of guilt. And it's only at that point does the military judge overrule defense's objection. So the circumstances of this, while the military judge does not put any rationale on the record, the circumstances of the exchange indicate that she's disregarded res geste as a possible theory of admission, but does agree with the description that the trial counsel just made, which is that it is...
But where does she say, aha, you're right? Where does she give any explanation about why she's admitting this evidence? Why should we at the appellate level here start intuiting what a military judge has done here? Why should we give the government the benefit of the doubt when it's not on the clear record before us?
Your Honor, her ruling, is afforded less deference due to her lack of rationale or findings on the record. Certainly that's true. The government's position is that the record itself is enough for this court to discern what occurred and why the military judge made the ruling in the way she did. That is evidenced by the defense counsel's 1106 matters, where he talked about consciousness of guilt, how this came in as consciousness of guilt. That's indicative that the courtroom knew what was going on, and that's the avenue of admission. Admittedly, it is not clear from her ruling of why she was bringing it in. However, there are the context that allows this court to make that decision. In terms of whether or not the defense counsel was essentially on notice, that goes to the second point of that this evidence is not covered by Military Rule of Evidence 404B. And therefore, the 404B notice requirement would not apply. There's nothing in the record to indicate that the defense counsel was unaware of the existence of this evidence. Rather, they objected on a 404B basis, claiming that they did not get 404B notice. If the evidence is not covered by 404B, then that is just like every other evidence that would require basic notice through discovery. They did not make a discovery claim. They did not make a claim of violation of any sort of Brady or Stellato or anything of that nature. This is simply a 404B, which the military judge says, I don't see, or how does this implicate 404B? I don't see the connection to 404B. She indicating that she doesn't feel as though this is 404B.
So what authority, what precedents, what rule can you point to that supports your position that 404B and notice requirements don't apply when consciousness of guilt is, as you put it, consciousness of, in your brief, consciousness of guilt evidence does not involve propensity? How does that fit with our holding in United States versus Staten?
Your Honor, the government points to United States versus Quezada, where this court, in a different issue, talked about how consciousness of guilt is different than propensity evidence and can be different than propensity evidence. That consciousness of guilt is a form of circumstantial evidence used to show awareness that he or she engaged in blameworthy conduct. The issue, the government's position is that there can be evidence that fits both categories, a Venn diagram of sorts, where you can have evidence that is both consciousness of guilt and could implicate character in term, and then to show propensity. That is not the case in this case. And this evidence here does not, on its face, implicate propensity. It just simply shows a consciousness of guilt.
Okay, so looking at your, I'm sorry, Judge Mack, did you have a question?
Please, sir.
You're saying you have consciousness of guilt in your Venn diagram that may involve or does involve propensity, and then you can have consciousness of guilt that does not. What authority are you citing for drawing that distinction?
Your Honor, I cite to the rule 404B, and 404B1 talks about that the acts or wrongs or other crimes must be evidence to prove a person's character, and that to then show that they acted in accordance with that character. So if it's on its face does not prove a person's character, then 404B doesn't apply. The 404 rule of character evidence wouldn't be applicable. If it could, on its face, implicate a person's character, then the rest of 404B would have to be followed. But there are cases where somebody...
Counsel, can I ask you just about that last sentence that you said? 404B1 says evidence of a crime, wrong, or other act is not admissible to prove a person's character in order to show that on a particular occasion the person acted in accordance with that character. And let's assume that we're with you, just for the sake that this doesn't fit within B1 because you weren't attempting to prove the character. Instead, you were attempting to prove consciousness of guilt. But then B2 says this evidence, In other words, evidence of an act may be admissible for another purpose, such as proving motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity. Why wouldn't this still fit within B2? Because it is evidence of an act. And in such case, even though you're not using it to prove character, don't you still have to provide notice under the third sentence, the second sentence of B2, the third sentence of B altogether? In other words, we're not in B1, but why aren't you in B2?
Your Honor, the government reads that sentence, the first sentence of B2, to indicate that this evidence is referring to evidence of crimes, wrongs, or other acts used to show character. And couches the argument that 404B deals with character, or 404 generally deals with character. If every other act had to be noticed regardless, then the government would be required to provide 404B notice for any act that the accused did outside of the res gestae of the crime.
Well, that then brings me to the next question, which is if you look at the second sentence in 404B2, it says, on request by the accused, the prosecution must provide. It's not a general notice requirement. It's a notice requirement upon the request of the accused. I didn't notice much in your brief about that limitation, the on request by the accused. What do you make of that limitation?
Your Honor, the evidence in this case doesn't indicate that the accused did not put a 404B request in. There was 404B notice of other acts in this case, so the government didn't identify that as an issue in this particular fact.
And then if you look at 404B2A, all the government's required to do is provide reasonable notice of the general nature of the evidence that the prosecution intends to offer at trial. Does that mean you have to explain the reason you want to introduce it? Consciousness of guilt or intent or preparation? Or does it just mean you have to say, we're going to introduce search evidence?
Your Honor, under the set of rules that you just described, which were in place at the time, there would be no requirement outside of the general nature of the offenses or of the acts. In this case, again, there's nothing to indicate that didn't occur. However, the government does not have anything in the record to point that it also did occur. We don't have that in the record. But if hypothetically the government provided these notice or these search terms in an Article 32 packet or in discovery, that would be sufficient to meet the 404B notice requirement. Then it would be the defense's obligation to object based on that to get further explanation as to how and why they want to bring it in.
Thank you.
Assuming the military judge did abuse her discretion in determining that this was consciousness of guilt and admitting this evidence, there was no impact on the findings or sentence in this case. The government's case was overwhelming. It was extremely strong. We have testimony from the victim. You had admissions by the accused. You had a third-party witness who, although they did not see the act itself, gave very good circumstantial evidence to support the victim's testimony. You also had a very weak defense case. This was largely just inconsistencies with a child victim who had a perhaps incomplete understanding of what sexual intercourse was. And as this court said in United States v. Cano, that doesn't necessarily make a government's case weak just because a child is inconsistent in her testimony. The quality of the evidence was low. As appellant notes, this could have been after his CID interview where these terms were implanted into his head. It could have occurred before. It's largely unknown from the record. But the evidence itself is the quality is weak. We're not sure when it occurred, and we're not sure in what circumstances he's searching, other than it happened after the actual event. And finally, the materiality is low. This wasn't a focal point of the case for the government. They had evidence of his consciousness of guilt through his statements to CID, where he said, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done what I did. We have statements made by him to the third-party witness where he shrugged and said, when a man sees a woman, and kind of identified that he had done it. The materiality, this was not a large part of the case at all for the government. It's one mention in closing argument for the findings right before they list all of his admissions to CID, so it's encapsulated in that. And the government does not even bring up these searches in the sentencing argument. And for those reasons, that if the military judge had abused her discretion, the evidence had no impact on the findings or the sentence in this case, and this court should affirm the lower court's ruling.
Questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Captain Armstrong?
The fact that the government says the record is unclear when the search has occurred, maybe after CID, before CID, shows that they did not meet their burden. And the other thing to
if you would, please, Captain Armstrong, if you bring the microphone down a little closer to you.
The other thing I want to clarify is, although he said they weren't offering for character purpose, that's exactly what they used it. So for a propensity purpose. So that's why where the prejudice lies. Government's arguing he knew this was an assault, but because he just was advised by the CID agents in the search terms, track with what was discussed at the CID interview at hour and 10, he was asked about what the proper punishment, hour 2 and 10, he's asking the CID agent, can you explain to me what sexual assault is law-wise? And it doesn't seem clear that he was satisfied with this explanation, and the word choking was suggested by the CID agent. So all of these things point to the improper use, because the military judge was explained this had happened immediately after the assault, and this is not the case. And she got the impression the appellant had done these things and immediately start searching because he had forethought, malice, and with actual planning and grooming, and they're painting him as a predator. And that's why this is so prejudicial. And it's clear the fact finder was impacted by that because she gave an extremely high sentence for him. The other reason why you should not affirm the decision is danger of viewing this evidence as a consciousness of guilt would make everything, a lot of extrinsic evidence, as consciousness of guilt evidence. And especially this was after appellant was advised again, if he was, for example, a pro se person, he's basically conducting illegal research. That's why this is evidence is highly prejudicial. Pending any questions?
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:20.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:20.